don't, I'm not the kind of faculty member who fights a distracted week, so I'm just going to kind of accept that we're working on a little bit of thin preparation, and I would like to encourage you still to bring your readings to class and be able to access them in real time in class, because I think that makes things more interactive and fun. And but I understand that during a distracted week that tends to happen a little less. So, you know, I think we should just ride out this week. If things kind of stay slow next week, maybe we'll do some quizzes or whatever we need to do. But let's just see what we can do today, okay? Because I think I'm assuming you guys read. I did pull one reading out of our required reading, and I'll just give you a little bit of information about that one. And then we have the carb chapter to do today. Did you guys get through your worksheet okay? And then you turned it in? Because the idea would be to turn it in before we actually, you know, go over it.
So the Q&R drop off.
Yeah, is that what you put it? Where you put it? I gave you a Google form for that.
Oh, my bad.
Do you mind? Can you put it in your Google form?
Yeah. I didn't know you wanted us to turn it in. Last class we didn't.
Yeah, that was practice. I'm sorry. I'm notoriously bad about this. Could you just
turn it in tonight?
Yeah, tonight will be okay for the carbs. You know, the carbs will survive.
That's
And then he needs to find the form. I sent you the form link in. Yeah, everybody's doing it now. I sent you the form link in your email. Sorry, I could have put it on the wiki.
That's
okay. We'll sort it out, so we'll allow a little extra time, and then I'll prompt you next week to get it in before class. Okay, so yeah, let's get into our stuff. Any food news today? We didn't have much in the other class. I have a book to share with you. I'll tell you about this, and maybe some of you can think about whether you've made any food discoveries. This is a nice book. B. Wilson did a really good first book, which I hadn't read, called Consider the Fork. This is a kind of food writing that's kind of personal. It's not... It'll have some research in it. It won't be research-based. She's writing about how we come to learn to eat certain foods. She's also writing from a standpoint of having had a difficult relationship with food. So she had a kind of... she didn't describe herself as anorexic, but she described herself as having kind of a problem relationship with food. So she's reflecting on that. And then she's also thinking about raising kids and getting them to eat well. And so I've just started it, and it looks well written, and she was highly acclaimed for the first book. So you could browse that, see if that interests you. And maybe that'll work for somebody. Okay, no food news? Yes?
Christina and I got together over the weekend, and we watched a couple documentaries.
Oh, good. Which ones did you watch?
So we watched Forks Over Knives.
I haven't seen that one. What's that like? Is that good?
Yeah, we watched that.
That
was the first one.
What's Forks Over Knives about?
That was a lot about the meat industry and a lot of research and showing how meat has kind of negatively affected our bodies. And
okay.
They did a lot of research like in Japan and like did a lot of controlled experiments to
okay.
see how people's like... had a lot of science in it.
Did they talk about the China study? Or?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's based a lot on the idea I'm talking about, a whole foods plant-based
right.
diet. And
right.
then it talked a lot about legislation that has tried to go through that's been kind of denied a little bit.
What would that legislation have done? Promote whole foods? Or?
The one on that one was, or maybe I'm like,
that was from the GMO.
Never mind. One.
Ah,
never
so
mind.
Okay, so
that
you watched
the
GMO.
That was GMO labeling.
Yeah.
What was the GMO movie called?
GMO OMG.
That's funny. I haven't heard of that.
Yeah,
one.
It's actually really good.
That one you liked too?
Yeah, together with that was my favorite.
Right.
And they talked a lot about that was the one where they talked a lot about the legislation behind labeling, and just I was very taken aback by.
Yeah.
You can't really get food that doesn't have GMOs in it these days.
Right. I don't have a. Have any of you researched the GMO issue in other classes or other contexts? You did a little bit. I'm still not sure. I don't have my bearings on that issue. It seems like I've heard credible science that says don't worry about GMOs, but then the Europeans are all about anti-GMO.
Right.
And
yeah.
Could they all be wrong? I don't know. Did Sam? Did you come up with anything on this?
I did in high school, and it was all about Monsanto.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, there's the seed control issue. That's a big issue. We saw that.
Yeah.
The
they talked about that.
It's just like, I've read a lot of things that say don't worry too much about
right.
it.
Right.
But then there's part of me that thinks it's gross that we
well.
Modify
it. You know, it seems like the next generation of that's going to be the CRISPR technology. You know, that's that genetic editing technology, which is just phenomenal, apparently. And so I can imagine us editing plants, DNA, for various reasons. But yeah, did you so you recommend both of them?
Yeah, and something about the GMO one that they were talking that of it was a study done in France. The Monsanto, when they did the research, it was only a 3-month-long experiment.
Okay.
And then in France, they did like a
2-year
experiment, and they saw a lot of results that started to the actual signs started to show in the 4th and 5th months.
This is an experiment on health effects or experiments on the plants themselves?
On health effects on rats.
Ah, okay.
And so,
okay.
And how tumors grew in them.
Oh, wow.
Times when they had GMO versus non-GMO products.
Yeah.
Or food. And it was really interesting because I think that was the big push to put a lot of European nations to ban GMO. They said a lot of, like, you know, Poland and other countries, like, banned for 5 years, 10 years. But Monsanto and a lot of other U.S. companies like discredited his research.
Right.
So it was just, it was really
so there's
easy
a real
to like look at that study that, I mean, I feel like most of the time no one heard about, you know.
Right. Right. I want to dive into it more. I mean, there was recent news on the Monsanto cancer case because, you know, there's a class action case about whether Roundup causes cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important to the GMO issue because, of course, we've modified the plants so that they tolerate Roundup. The old story was that Roundup always dissolves into the soil. It's always inert. But this case, this is suggesting otherwise. So, yeah, there's definitely GMO health issues out there, but there's also just a lot of push. There's a lot of authoritative stuff on the other side. Good. Yeah, good. Some of you are watching movies. In the other class, somebody was talking about Bite Size, which is an obesity movie relevant to today's class. So dig into those movie lists. There's many of them are available to you, and it's kind of a neat way to kind of acquire new knowledge, but also to check out your own food knowledge at this point in the semester. You guys know a lot of stuff, and so you can kind of watch these films with a more critical eye than maybe the first few documentaries that you watched. Good. Yeah. Anybody else? We're good. Okay. Let's get to our content today. We've got some good stuff, and I'm going to try to do it kind of lightly because I don't know. I want to see if you guys can chime in with stuff. So if you have the readings on a screen or in print, let's do that. Our goal today in terms of study questions is to kind of understand how the cereal wars in the 80s show something about the competitive relationship between cereal producers and consumer behavior. That question made a lot of sense when I wrote it. Now I'm a little puzzled by it. Let's see if we can figure that out. And then we really kind of want to get a handle on carbs and what, you know, what our knowledge of carbs in the Western diet is telling us. And that's kind of implicit in a couple of things in the carb chapter. But with that one, we're going to kind of work through our worksheet and kind of make sure we understand what we need about carbs. Okay, so the chapter that I didn't ask you to read or made optional today was the Moss chapter 11. So I'm just going to kind of, you can read this, and I'm going to just say a couple words about it. I originally wanted this chapter in here because it tells a story about Kraft's effort to respond to the obesity epidemic. And there was this group, or cabal, he refers to as within Kraft, that was already talking about how they needed to make Kraft foods healthier. And that, you know, this was in the 70s when the same time frame as the chapter you did read, when concerns about childhood obesity and obesity among adults was coming out. So then the story develops nicely because it turns out Kraft, of course, was bought by Philip Morris, the tobacco company. And some of the executives that were still working for Philip Morris had been through the tobacco litigation. Do you remember the tobacco litigation? There was a huge class action suit that the tobacco industry settled for costs imposed from cigarettes before we officially knew they were cancer-causing. So that was a liability case that was, I can't remember how many billions of dollars the tobacco industry paid for that. So these are the new owners, and so they say to these people at Kraft who are thinking about reducing fat and sugar and salt in the products, Yeah, go for it. Yeah, we've been through this with tobacco. This is really bad. You know, we really need to kind of respond to the public health issue, right? So this is a good story about corporate social responsibility so far. And then as you get into the chat, and so this group proposes some really innovative things like packaged nutrition labeling. Do you know what packaged nutrition labeling is? That's where you say, you acknowledge that when people buy a bag of potato chips, they often just kind of like go through the whole thing, right? So instead of serving size nutrition information, packaged nutrition information tells you the total calories and fat and nutrients in the whole package. Because it's an assumption, the assumption is you're going to eat the whole package. So you see what I mean? So serving size is, as you know, serving size is one of the places where you can fudge because you just reduce the serving size and it looks like, oh, this isn't so bad. But of course, we don't follow the serving size. They suggested things like that. They suggested reduction in calories from products. They suggested reducing the indulge messaging in marketing. They suggested restraint in marketing to kids. They removed literally billions of, this is amazing to think that you can do this. They removed billions of calories from the product line. Capri Sun lost 120 billion calories. They cut about 1 trillion calories out of the foods they sold. They re-engineered a lot of their products. And then the story takes kind of a dark turn because sales tanked and Wall Street came in and said, what are you guys doing? This is a publicly traded corporation. You're supposed to earn a return on investment. You just did something that you thought was good for the country, but it didn't help your sales. And so the CEO gets fired and all the people who had this kind of idealistic idea that they were going to keep selling the same amount of food that wouldn't have these addictive properties. So it's a story. It's a good. Do you feel the story? It's kind of a good story, but it has a sad ending. Okay. So that's kind of the gist of that chapter, and I hope you're glad I saved you about 20 pages of reading, unless you read it anyway, which might have been good. Okay. That is. The Moss book does a good job of kind of bringing the industry side of this. And we studied this a little bit at the beginning of this semester when we had government, the interaction between government and regulation in the industry. So then let's get into our Moss chapter. If you have that chapter handy, could you take it out and page through it to remind yourself of what you read there? I think a good place to start your notes is with two shock statistics from the chapter. Okay, the first one is that cereal sales go from 660 million to 4.4 billion in less than 20 years. So this is a huge industry. You learn in the chapter, what are some of the social changes that led to this growth? This didn't just happen by itself. Why did people go for industrial breakfast cereal in huge numbers in the 70s and 80s? Anybody remember? Yeah, please. Yeah, women's labor participation went up, and women were still responsible for are still in most cases still responsible for being the primary nutritionists in the family.
Marketing.
Yeah, a lot of marketing happened. Kids became more powerful deciders in choosing foods. How many of you were able to go as kids with your mom or dad or both to the supermarket and influence their choices about cereals? I mean, once the advertising to kids for the kids' shows helped fuel this, but there's also just a shift in the culture to where a lot of marketers, you remember the passage in the chapter, a lot of corporate executives are just saying from a marketing standpoint, hey, we've got to talk to the kid. You know, you can market to the parent, but it's the kid that's kind of the decider in a lot of these things. And when I was growing up, it wouldn't have occurred to me at all. You know, I'll just take you back quite a few decades. It would never have occurred to me to try to lobby my parents in the supermarket for a particular choice. I mean, we started to a little bit as we were growing older, but it was just, the point for your notes is that the social ethos in the country changed not only because of labor participation by women, but because children became bigger deciders in the marketplace across a lot of products, not just breakfast cereal. Okay. So the other big shock statistic in the chapter is that 2/3 of the price of the cereal is in the advertising, which many of you might have suspected, right? There's a lot of money in the advertising. So could we just dilate on that for a minute? What does this box of cereal cost these days? About $4 or $5? Is that what it is? Okay. So $1.25 is that right? No, a little more. $1.75 is the cereal, the actual produced cereal. How do you guys think about the value of that as a food product if you're paying basically 3 times what it costs to make the actual physical product?
My argument there is that cereal is not the only food that does that. I mean, are there plenty of other packaged products?
That's a good question. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that.
The price is a bunch.
Well, no, that, I mean,
it doesn't cost
it,
them anything to do absolutely. While we will spend plenty of money.
Absolutely. So we could ask about the advertising ratio for any industrial food product, but compared to carrots and potatoes, right? There are people spending a little money. Like the Potato Association is going to run a commercial once in a while to say, "Hey, don't forget about potatoes." But yeah, so we could ask. So good point. We could ask that question about any food product. Others. So how do you do the value calculation? So suppose you were trying to figure out whether you should stick with your industrial cereal at $5 a box or shift to another food product. Could we just take each other through that? How would you do that? How would you make the analysis? Frosted Mini Wheats were one of my favorites. Does anybody like, what were your favorite cereal? Yeah, I mean, come on, that's a quality cereal. They got the crunch and the sugar just right.
I feel like personally, I equal cereal with oatmeal a lot, which I know
yeah.
a lot of people don't do.
Right.
But I feel like they're both kind of like good carbs in the morning.
Right.
But like I know I can buy oats in bulk that's
right.
not prepackaged.
Right.
And I feel like for me, that's like harder to be like, well, I'm not gonna unless I go to Costco. I guess I could get like bulk cereal, but I feel like it's cheaper per meal I have of oatmeal versus cereal when. Pretty even playing ground for like satisfaction.
Right. So that's where I'm going with this. That's exactly where I'm going. You hear that? You would come up with a competitor food for breakfast, even if it's one that initially you're like, I don't know if I want to eat that. The point isn't whether you would. That is a point because you would want to get. There's the satisfaction equation, but you come up with a competitor product that has, and then you compare the nutrition, the price. And the practicality, because one of the ways we got sold industrial cereal was by being told, hey, you know, there's nothing quicker than grabbing the box out of the bin and shaking it into a bowl, right? I mean, that's probably one of the fastest ways to make breakfast. But so that's a practicality point. You have a lot of information, and you're going to get more today, about why there's compromised nutrition in industrial cereal. But industrial cereal produces high satisfaction rates. So in doing this comparison, you'd have to ask yourself, would the competitor natural breakfast food be more expensive, more or less satisfying, and more or less practical? Do you see how you would do that calculation? I mean, it's a really practical thing to do. And I'd encourage you to think about it, especially if you're eating industrial cereals, because they are really wonderful. I ate them for years. I mean, they do what they do really well. They manage the taste experience in terms of texture and crunch. They give you sugar that mixes with the lactase sugar and the lactose in the milk. It's just a very sugary experience. You learn from this chapter that that breakfast cereals can be over 50% sugar. I mean, the practical point from this chapter for me was, wow, how do people continue to believe in the value of a $5 box of cereal that's 2/3 advertising and the 1/3 that is product is compromised nutritionally? And part of the answer is we get addicted to sugar easily. Another part of the answer is it's more practical. But if you're trying to be a practical foodie, then you take that and you say, okay, that's why people do that. So then try to think about how you would make a comparison. And if that's an upgrade that you want to make in your diet, then that could be part of your diet review work if you want to. Okay, so getting through the chapter's narrative, let's see if we can get you some notes on this. the main story in this chapter is the cereal wars, okay? So where did the cereal wars come from? By the cereal wars, we mean the highly competitive atmosphere over breakfast cereal that emerged especially after sensitivity about obesity. So the point for your notes is that the cereal wars were a competitive response within the industry to obesity data. And some of this came about when dentists tried to get the federal government. The dentists are seeing a lot of tooth decay and increases in tooth decay, and they try to get the federal government to measure sugar levels, and they won't do it because Big Sugar doesn't want that to happen. We've already talked about how the DRI for sugar doesn't exist on our food labels because the sugar industry doesn't want that to be there. So you get a kind of stunt where a bunch of dentists bring hundreds of decayed teeth. Do you remember that from the chapter? Bring hundreds of decayed teeth to Washington as part of a campaign to get people to respond. And then the FTC, this is part of the narrative. Notice we're back to 1997, which was a date that you should remember because it's associated with the McGovern Commission, which was the first committee to try to produce federal guidelines. So now we're in the same period of time, but now we've got the FTC responding. And this is Jimmy Carter, so it's a politically liberal, maybe activist administration. So what does the FTC do? They respond by proposing a ban of all advertising to kids. Okay, so this fails, and the point for your notes is this fails for really culturally deep reasons. In our culture, we place a really high value on consumer responsibility. So the FTC got labeled as the national nanny because it seemed like government overreach, paternalistic government overreach, right? For the government to say, well, we can't let kids see all these advertisements. I mean, aren't there parents in those houses that are really responsible? You hear the argument. It's a pretty solid argument. Consumer responsibility requires people except for really dangerous products, right? Okay. It requires people to take responsibility for their decisions. And then in the previous class, that's when one of the students said that she had watched Bite Size, which is on your movie list. And Bite Size is really neat for this issue because it gives you some insight about why families don't make better choices when it comes to their kids' health and weight problems. Bite Size follows four kids who have serious obesity issues. And it takes you into their families, takes you to their schools, takes you to the doctor with them. And it really provides some neat insights about it. And if I had to summarize it in a bit, it would be that consumer responsibility makes a lot of sense, except that the adults in these households are not much better or no better informed than the kids. So you have these really overweight kids who are going to fat camps, they're going on extreme medical regimens. And then you follow them home, and you find that they're just eating horrible food all day. And the parents are like, oh, I'm so worried about, I can't remember, there's four kids in the movie. I'm so worried about Johnny, and he's 300 pounds. And yet the parents are buying that food. And even at the doctor's office, the doctor's kind of passive. Like, oh, how are you doing? Instead of like, oh, you're killing yourself. This is really serious. So anyway, it's a good movie for this because it kind of gets at this national nanny issue, this issue of paternalism. Any thoughts on that? Did you feel like you, as you were growing up, maybe you had very well informed parents, maybe you had parents who acceded to your wishes more? Did you feel that spectrum? Did that exist in your childhood and growing up? Okay, so the cereal wars themselves refer to this. This shift really brought about by the competitiveness of this atmosphere. And what you learn in this part of the chapter is that a crucial innovation, this is a good point for your notes, a crucial change occurred at this time at Kellogg's, where instead of asking the food scientists to produce a product and then the marketers to market it, they reverse this relationship. This is a crucial thing for your notes because this gets at the kid advertising, the advertising dimension of industrial cereal. So they put the marketers in charge of product development. And one of the stories for this is this Rice Krispies story. How many of you have eaten Rice Krispies treats? Like almost every, it's a real American food, right? And it's yummy. And so they tried to get Rice Krispies treats into a cereal box. And it reminds me of, didn't they try to do this with s'mores as well? Do you remember that? And so they couldn't do it. They couldn't get the texture. That's one of the cool things about Rice Krispies treats, right? So instead what they figured out is they just need the flavor. So this is a point where I want to play you this commercial. Maybe some of you...
Rice Krispies are garbage, though. Like the cereal.
The cereal doesn't do much for me. I was an Apple Jacks man myself. But I don't come from this era of Apple Jacks. What were your favorite cereals?
Well, I forgot about that commercial, but now it's like...
It's back. It comes back. Yeah. I can tell you about commercials. Like, I can tell you about commercials when I was a kid. Yeah. That's part of this issue. Okay, can we watch it?
Now that I think about it.
See you, stick man. It's your mask. Keep eating my baby. Applejacks. I have so earned this.
This is around 2005. Yeah, okay.
What?
Applejack cereal with a taste of apples?
No!
Only in his dreams, because it's the taste of sweet cinnamon that's really part of a nutritious breakfast.
Applejacks? I don't want to get into them anyway.
Did you notice the picture of the cut apple there?
Yeah.
So this was a weird result. I mean, this is where Apple, the marketers actually said, okay, the problem with Apple Jacks is the apple. The apple is too healthy. So they made the apple bad apple, and they made the good character cinnamon. And bad apple dreams that Apple Jacks will someday taste like apples. Remember that? You just watched it, right? And in your dreams, apple. And so the idea is that the marketers actually took aim against the central image in the product, Apple Jacks, because cinnamon was a lot cooler. So they could turn cinnamon into this Rasta kind of guy, you know, and apple turns out to be the pathetic character.
But then at the end they say part of a nutritious balanced breakfast or something like that.
Right, and that's where you see the sliced apple, the beautiful sliced apple there in front. And it's just, I mean, isn't it? It's pretty weird. Any reactions to that? This was from your formative years, right?
There was also another commercial on Nickelodeon about sugar.
Uh-huh.
Way back in the
for
day.
A product or for?
No, just for sugar.
Just how wonderful sugar is.
I don't know what made me think of it, but when I was doing the readings and whatnot.
If you find it. Some of these old commercials are really interesting for doing food.
Yeah.
What?
It was about how everything was bad. It said... It would tell you like all these different names for sugar, and it's like everything that rhymes with gross is another word for sugar. So
oh, really?
It was
pushing against. Oh, yeah. Good luck.
So, like, even when I read nutrition labels today, like, I still think of that.
How interesting. Right. Yeah. No, advertising's huge here, and it's. How do I get out of this situation? Did this bring any other advertising? And I don't. When you guys were growing up, did they prohibit tie-ins to television programs? Did you have serial characters in your TV programs? Yeah, I think they got rid of that. When I was a kid, there was like the Captain Crunch show. You know? Yeah. The character would be like a main. Yeah, it was kind of cool. I mean, it's a food marketer's dream because all the commercials can be Captain Crunch commercials, and you know. And Captain Crunch was kind of cool. I mean, he was this captain, you know. Okay, so let's see. Where are we with our story? So this is evidence. The cinnamon commercial, the bad apple cinnamon commercial, is kind of evidence of the extreme dimension that this took. And as I was prepping this today, I was thinking, you know, some of you have heard this phrase post-truth in relation to politics. Has anybody heard that? What does that mean when people say that? No.
It's kind of like there isn't an answer to questions. You can rationalize any answer, and it can, everything's subjective. There's nothing objective
right.
anymore.
Good, very good. Yeah, and it's related to changes in the journalism industry that make it harder to know when you're looking at news journalism versus commentary. It refers to fake news, right? And so you could argue that we entered a post-truth era in food before we did in politics, because it didn't seem like the truth about the cereal mattered at all. It was a completely manipulable truth about the cereal. So if you want to, if we're carb phobic, we'll reduce the we'll reduce that. If we're lipophobic, we'll reduce that. And the chapter ends with a really interesting tie-in, which is that, and I didn't notice this until I reread it today. So Whole Food, one of the ways that Frosted Mini Wheats tries to rebrand itself, because it's just it's absolute sugar, is that it gets sold as brain food. And parents are getting told that if they give their kids Frosted Mini Wheats, they'll get better grades. They'll be more attentive. Did any of you hear those messages about brain food?
And like the commercials of like the kids studying and then the little frosted plate like on his shoulder.
Oh, neat! Like, I don't remember that. Okay, cool.
You're gonna
get
A today.
Yeah, that's right. So there's tie-ins to school performance, and isn't it interesting that that Post, remember he was one of the original people who went to the Kellogg Spa, he originally promoted grape nuts as a kind of brain food.
Also good.
But also garbage, contemporary. I don't know what his original grape nuts were like, but they never had any grape in them. I didn't understand that until...
Are they really
not
good for you?
No, they're good for you. They're just really not good.
They're not as yummy as...
They're good for you, though.
Yeah, they are good.
It's like brown sugar.
They're a little better. Yeah. Okay, so do we have this chapter kind of figured out? I mean, I think we're really looking at we've got a couple of stories. Let's make sure it's all in your notes. One story is the obesity epidemic and the corporate response, the government response. But the other story is this kind of post-truth world of industrial cereals, where the underlying reality of the cereal becomes the least interesting or important part of the whole equation. And as a culture, I'm getting back to the responsibility point, we all kind of are responsible for this. I mean, there are adults in the country. And so even though our nutrition information is bad and we had problems adapting to lifestyles where women were participating in the labor force, this does seem like a problem that partly is our fault. Like, we can make that value comparison that I talked about earlier. You guys have more resources than most people now to make really good value comparisons on nutrition, practicality, and satisfaction. And I'll just say, maybe it's obvious what my opinion would be, is that the practicality advantages of industrial food are pretty oversold. They're practical if you don't have a clue about what else you might be able to do. If you start to develop a food repertoire, more knowledge about nutrition, more knowledge about actually making food yourself rather than just buying food products, then you're in a position to make this value calculation. And that's where you're in a position to really kind of become responsible for your food, which is kind of one of the goals I had in studying food, was to become responsible for my own diet and to be less clueless about it. I spent so much time learning about philosophy compared to the time I'd spent learning about how to eat well. At some point, it kind of startled me. Okay, any thoughts on that? We good? What do you think? Okay, let's do a little work on our carb chapter. Can we just kind of get clear on a few things about the carb chapter? Maybe if you did the worksheet, you have those answers handy. That can kind of speed us through. I did give you a couple of technical articles. I'll just flash on the screen. One is about from a nutrition journal about high fructose corn syrup, because the chapter referenced some things about that, but it didn't really go into that so much. And this is taking a while to load, so I don't think it really matters. We can look at it. And then another article that I thought would... this is one you've actually seen before, because when we were talking about fiber in industrial foods, remember we discovered this distinction between between synthetic fibers, manufactured isolated fibers, synthetically manufactured, and then natural fibers, which divide into soluble and insoluble. So if you want to drill down a little more on types of fiber, or if you want to know a little more about how high fructose corn syrup works in your metabolism, you might want to get a little more technical reading there. Okay. But let's take it from the top on our carb thing, and then we'll pull some, there's a few other details from the chapter that I want to get out. So what are carb, almost too easy a question, right? What are carbohydrates chemically?
Carbon,
hydrogen, right? And they vary. The more interesting stuff starts to happen now. How do they vary? How do carbohydrates vary from amongst themselves. Yep.
Just like the amount of sugar molecules.
Right. Right. So from monosaccharides, disaccharides to polysaccharides, and as you move up that scale, what other terms do you start to use for carbs that are more complex? Starches? Yeah. Right. So what? So yeah, also, so the point for your notes that all this is a point of confusion, I think. All carbs are sugar ultimately, right? All, not because they are sugar in their natural state, but because all carbs are metabolized in your body as sugar. So you're always breaking down the starches. You don't metabolize the starch directly into your bloodstream. So from the idea that all carbs are sugar, I think a lot of people get the impression that all sugars are going to be the same in your body, and that's clearly not true, and that's what we know now. So so carbs vary by complexity, and then are there carbs in milk? This is just a simple thing that I just was ignorant about. I just didn't count the sugar of lactose as a carb, but it clearly is. It's a saccharide. Okay. Did you notice this shock statistic that carb, this goes along with the sugar, the cereal sales thing. High fructose corn syrup consumption increased from 0.12 teaspoons a day in 1970 to 11 teaspoons a day in 2008. That's a 100-fold increase. And there's other historical data that when Europeans started making cane sugar in big quantities, sugar increase, there's one statistic from this one book that sugar consumption increased in Britain like 2,000%. I mean, with sugar, you have to really treat, you know, this fMRI data that sugar lights up areas of our brain that seem similar to the areas that are lit up with addictive responses. So sugar is pretty serious stuff, and that's why we should pay attention to carbs. Okay, what is the significance? Between difference between soluble and non-soluble dietary fiber, anything? Would you guys get on that? Did you pull this up?
Yeah. I wrote greater water holding capacity than gums and a few other things.
Okay. That's a good start. What else? There's some more detail there. Yeah? Okay. Okay. Water solubility is related to mineral uptake. That was one of the details. Good. Yeah.
I wrote how recommendations for fiber consumption were based on water solubility.
Right.
So soluble fiber has the ability to bind bile acids and ultimately lower blood cholesterol levels.
Good.
And insoluble fiber is ability to relieve like constipation.
Right. So insoluble fiber, there are some people who say that your gut actually recovers some carbohydrates from so-called insoluble fiber. But that helped us. The soluble fiber also has this interesting property of attracting water, as a couple of you said, and so it's related to satiety, too. So eating complex carbs with significant amounts of soluble fiber help you achieve satisfaction because literally your body and metabolism kind of fill up. You feel full. And that happens partly because of the soluble fiber. So when you look at all carbs, you realize now that carbs are not all the same. Even though they're metabolized all as sugar, when you look at fiber, you realize fiber is not all the same. Some fiber is related to your feeling of fullness, reduction of cholesterol. Other fiber, like insoluble fiber, it feeds your microbiota. So the point for your notes would be that when you eat carbs, you're not just eating for you. You're eating, this is what, I've read this in other food writing, you know, it's pretty interesting. It stuck with me. When you eat carbs, you're not just eating for you because you're feeding your gut bacteria. Protein and fats don't get into the large intestines in significant amounts. By the time you've got the stuff that's going through your large intestines, ultimately your stools, those are ultimately carbs. There's other stuff in there, too. But it's mostly carbs, insoluble carbs. And so when you think about these, I mean, I'll probably come back to the microbiota more, but you have 10 to the 15 bacteria per millimeter in your large intestine. You are host to trillions of bacteria. And the more we're learning about microbiota, the more we're realizing that microbiotically available carbs are called MACs. Microbiotically available carbs are carbs that you can actually, you don't necessarily digest them in your large intestine, but your bacteria do, and they benefit from them. And the other point for your notes is the quality of insoluble carbs and the variety helps determine the kinds of bacteria you can feed. So your microbiota is at stake here. We know what fiber does for us now a little more. The controversy over net carbs got a little technical. I kind of felt like that. We had to dig for that one. Does anybody have a handy? That's on page 25. Does anybody have a short version of that? No? You didn't catch this? Yeah.
Isn't it that there's carbs in sugar and fiber, or carbs in sugar and something else that they don't put into the total?
Right.
Net carbs, so it looks like there's lower carbs than there actually
are. Right. So back, good. That's good. Let me redo it too. Yeah.
Isn't it like fibers and sugar alcohol have lower glycemic index?
Right. So when we became carbophobic, food producers wanted to report net carbs, which would allow them to lower the amount of carbs they reported. And the claim was that that some kinds of dietary fiber and sugar alcohols and carbs have lower glycemic index responses, so they shouldn't be counted as carbs. So you should be able to take them out. I mean, it's a way of fudging the details. And now that we know more about how carbs interact in your gut, the idea of writing off some of the carbs like that doesn't seem to make as much sense. It was kind of a food industry gimmick, I think, in retrospect. Sorry, that's a little more detailed than we need. Okay, the dietary reference intake is easy to calculate. I don't think we need to get in groups about that. You just took your calories, am I right? And you just kind of broke it out for the range. And so you have a sense of how many carbs you're recommended for. This is a small detail. Did everybody catch this? The proportion, the new advice is that you should have over half of your carbs from complex carbs. That's another way of getting at, you read this advice that you should have less than 10% of your calories from added sugar, right? So that's another way of getting at the same question. Since all carbs are not equal in your metabolism, you can either tell people to reduce added sugar, or you can tell people to maximize complex carbs. And I think that, what, do you guys have an intuition about which of those is better advice at this point? Which is it better to tell people to reduce added processed sugar in their diet, or just watch to see that the proportion of carbs is mostly complex? If you were giving advice from what you know in the course already, which advice would be better?
I would say reduce sugar, just because it's a lot easier to manage and a lot more easily understood, I guess.
Yeah.
Like,
so in favor of your answer, you could say, well, look, people generally know if they have a Coke or two a day. They generally know some of their added sugar. So that would be a really quick thing to tell someone, to point out, like, oh, I have three Cokes a day, or I have a big gulp every day, you know. So that would be, that argues for, I think that's a good point. What about the other way? Is there anybody who would have, I was tilting the other way initially. I was thinking, and I had a rationale, but I want to hear what you guys say.
I just feel like from maybe like a marketing perspective, like telling people to add more complex carbs,
mm-hmm.
they're not necessarily going to know what that means, but they're going to eat more like regular carbs,
right.
So it's not necessarily better for them, but if you're trying to sell more food, it might be better.
Good. Yeah, you guys, your answers are kind of reflecting a pretty good sophisticated idea of like how would people receive this information. Right, good.
I know in like in sports and stuff, it's advice to like tell someone what to do, not what not to do. Like,
yeah,
like,
good point. Good point, yeah. Yeah.
So, even though like complex carbs might not be as commonly known, like
right.
what that is,
yeah.
it would be easier advice to accept.
That's a good point. Yeah, my intuition was really kind of simple compared to what you guys are saying. My intuition was talking about added sugar kind of already grants that that's a category in your diet that's okay. But what if you took the, what if you started from the assumption that you didn't, that you were going to watch sugar in your diet and you weren't going to have added sugar? I mean, I know that's less practical. So I think I like the answers you guys gave. But I guess my intuition was learning to have over 50% complex carbs in your diet prompts you to kind of ask, so what is a complex carb and what are the differences between, you know, starchy vegetables and less starchy vegetables? Obviously, starchy vegetables are going to be vegetables that have more complex carbs in them. So it seemed to me it puts you on a path toward what you really need to know, which is how complex carbs help you, rather than a path of accepting that you've got a bunch of sugar in your diet and just kind of trying to limit that. And by the way, 10%, could somebody look up what a can of Coke has in terms of carbs? Because I think for an average diet, if I'm not mistaken, a can of Coke would basically be 10% of 2,000 calories.
24
grams. So how many, let's see that.
That's 8%.
8% of.
That is what it says on their nutrition facts.
Right, right. So that's 10% right there from a can, or 5%? Let's see. 24 grams of carbs? So that's, yeah, so two cans of Coke would be 10% of a 2,000 calorie diet. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I have a bias here because I think it might be, I don't know how you guys, how practical this would sound to you, but I think it might be more useful to just, to build your diet around things that, that aren't bad enough for you that you have to limit the amounts. The only exception I would make to that would be beer. But in general, you know, why would you make a place in your diet for processed sugar if you're getting plenty of good sugar and carbohydrates from other foods? So that would be kind of my bias on that. Okay, let's see if there might be a few more things in the chapter. There are actually a few notes I wanted to kind of go over with you, not too much. So let's just kind of take this in. As I was going through the chapter, I thought, okay, the dominant metaphor here for carbs is energy. We think about carbs as energy, and it's true, right? Because carbs, you know this from your reading of the chapter, carbs allow you to, carbs can be stored in your muscles and your liver for quick access to energy. You can burn up the amount of carbs that are typically available in your bloodstream and your muscles and roughly give you a couple of hours of exercise. I wanted to see what this looked like, so I found you an article that actually shows how glycogen looks in a muscle tissue. As you read in the chapter, that so they were able to mark the glycogen stores in this muscle. So literally, when you exercise, that's one of the places you're pulling carbs from, is in glycogen stores in your muscles. And this also relates to the ketosis diet, right? Because when you go through those carbs, if you're trying to go into ketosis, you want to burn up those stores because you want to get to the point where your body's burning fat instead of carbs. Okay. The thing I resisted, the only place where I really have some detailed notes here for you, is this energy metaphor is a little confusing to me. Maybe you guys have some thoughts on this. After all, carbs, fats, and proteins all have calories, so they all provide energy. And when I was looking at a later chapter in the nutrition textbook that goes into this, you know, it makes that point. So why would we talk about carbs as primarily energy if we get calories from all the macronutrients, right? And it's not a puzzle. I mean, the simple answer is that carbs have the most readily available forms of energy, right? So it's quick energy. It's the energy that we can burn as we're getting exercise. But I wanted to identify some limits to the energy metaphor, so this is where I'm going. First, and we know this already, carb levels and carb types help regulate insulin response. So already, energy isn't the only thing you should be thinking about with carbs. I think what a lot of people do is they say, oh, I'm going to go some physical exercise, I better load some carbs, right? And there's some logic to that, but if you're not thinking about the types of carbs, you're missing, the energy metaphor could be leading you astray. We've already mentioned how fiber helps with useful bacteria production, reduces colon cancer, helps with bowel function and avoiding diverticulosis. So it's not that carbs are just energy. They are also in foods that have carbs in the form of fiber are foods that have specific health effects. So Don't, I mean, this is kind of the pattern in a lot of stuff in this course. Don't look at an object like carbs as just the same as uniform. It matters what form you're getting, and it's doing more than just giving you energy to burn when you're active. Carbs, types, and levels signal the body whether to break down protein and fat for energy, so there's a balance between carb levels and other things that are in your diet. We already talked about soluble fiber, and we already talked about the per capita increase of HFCSs. And you can read more about that if you want to get a little bit better idea about how, because there is something puzzling here. You know, if you're saying, well, all carbs are sugars ultimately in metabolizing, so why is high fructose corn syrup any more problematic than any other sugar? And there are good answers to that, and there's some of those answers are in the chapter you got. If you wanted to go further in the science direction, you could read that article I linked for you. Okay. What are there some things? There is a warning for vegetarians here that's kind of interesting. You can have too high a fiber diet. And this came up in my diet design because a first version of my diet had a lot of fiber in it, like a ridiculous amount of fiber in it. And a really high fiber diet can reduce iron uptake. So it can kind of can reduce mineral uptake. Phytic acid somehow does that. Okay. All right, so let's just take a glance at the chapter together and see if there's anything else you want. Oh, there's one more thing I need to work into your notes, but I'll do that in a minute. Are we good? Do you guys have any questions coming out of this? Did this change your view of carbs a little bit, maybe?
I don't know.
Okay. One thing we didn't get into, I didn't feel like it was worth our class time, is to actually look at the carb profiles of particular foods. If you guys are thinking about your diets in connection with what we're reading, then that might be a useful part of the chapter for you to look at. Okay, I just want to end on this because it kind of comes up tangentially in this chapter, and I've been looking for an excuse to tell you about this wonderful topic. So this is going to take 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll break. I just want to remind you of where this comes up. Let's see. So you may have noticed on page 26, if you're taking notes on this, that there was a little text box on ethnicity and lactose intolerance. How fascinating. Let's talk about lactose intolerance. Okay. I want to get at it kind of indirectly because it brings up a really interesting food issue. So maybe some of you know this, but cultures that have dairying, that is, cultures that have adopted milk, cheese, and yogurts, and other dairy products, eggs. Cultures with dairying have 80% tolerance and 20% intolerance. Cultures without dairying are the opposite. So when I used to take students to Benin, I'd have conversations with Africans, and most of the Africans would say, oh, no, I can't drink milk. I can't eat ice cream. Now, yogurt and cheese aren't necessarily affected in the same way because they don't have check me if I'm wrong on those. People who are lactose intolerant can still often eat cheese and yogurt because it doesn't have lactose in it. So how did this come about? Why would cultures with dairying have such different profiles? Well, some of you might know this from your biology classes, but when almost all humans can digest lactose as infants, right? Because they have to be able to digest mother's milk. I don't know. There might be some infants that are lactose intolerant. I don't know. That seems really rare to me. So humans have always had a capacity to digest mother's milk. But our genes tend to switch that off as we get older. So most humans before agriculture wouldn't have been able to digest milk beyond infancy because we predominantly had variations of the gene that switched off lactase production, which is the enzyme you need to digest lactose. Once dairying came into some cultures, it put a selection pressure, a culturally induced selection pressure, evolutionary selection pressure, on people who had variants of the lactase gene that didn't switch off. So if you could keep digesting that, you had a huge advantage in a dairying culture, because what's the advantage in dairying? It's that you can keep this cow in the shed all winter and get huge protein out of it, right? You just have to put enough silage and grass by, and so you've got winter protein. So dairying made a huge impact on human nutrition, but it had this other impact, which people refer to as gene culture coevolution. In fact, this is the textbook example of gene culture coevolution. If you read it, you know, if you read about this, this is what comes up immediately. That dairying was one of the major examples in human food culture of a culturally created selection pressure that had an effect on the gene pool, a differential effect on the gene pools of cultures that had dairying and didn't have dairying. Isn't that fascinating? So it relates also to a kind of food injustice issue, because what you learn in this text box is that different ethnicities have different levels of lactose intolerance. What you don't learn without having this story is that that goes back to whether people with those from those ethnic origins come from cultures that had dairying. So where that was true, you find lactose intolerance, and where it wasn't, you find that it isn't. And I guess the reason this captures my imagination, I won't make too much of it, but maybe it's helpful to say this, is that it really raises the question of whether the Western diet, which we've been studying as, you know, a pretty unhealthy diet that's causing a lot of diseases, whether the Western diet is going to be another example of gene culture coevolution. What we could be doing effectively through the Western industrial diet is creating a selection pressure for people who can tolerate. Some people can tolerate the Western diet a lot better than others, just like some people can tolerate milk better than others. And so the interesting point is, it's kind of sad, is that the people who can tolerate the Western diet tend to be Northern European extraction. And so the Western diet is particularly lethal to ethnicities and cultures that didn't grow up in it, that don't have a long heritage of it. Because like with dairying, if your ancestors were in a meat culture for a long time, say, you, through a selection effect, plausibly, you developed, you are the result of a selection pressure that might make you more tolerant of that diet. So the point for your notes is that the Western diet isn't equally lethal. Just as we find out more about nutrition, we realize carbs have different effects on different bodies. Likewise, milk has different effects on different bodies. And our entire diet can be thought of as a giant gene culture coevolution experiment. What we're basically doing is putting a pressure on people who can survive this diet. And it turns out that pressure is felt differently depending upon your ethnic origin, because our ethnicities seem to reflect a history of selection, so that people are affected differently. I've already mentioned the obesity rates for African-American women and Hispanic women are in the 70s and 80% range. They will respond to the Western diet in a different way than other bodies. So there's a huge food justice issue here that's connected to gene culture coevolution. I just thought I'd kind of lay that out here because it comes up, it's mentioned in the chapter under lactose intolerance. Does that make sense? Is that clear? Yeah, question.
Do you know anything about how, like, alcohol affects Native Americans? I've heard about
that. Yes, right. That's a very good related issue.
Yeah.
There's a couple of theories on this. Maybe some of you have details on this. The short version that I know is that, in fact, different ethnicities have different enzymes, different capacities for breaking down alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And some people argue that both ethnicities that have trouble with alcohol, like Native Americans, and people who have trouble with alcohol, like alcoholics, might actually be getting a qualitatively richer experience from alcohol that makes it potentially more addictive. So the inability to break down alcohol might mean that you could actually get a heightened experience of alcohol, but that makes you more disposed to be addicted to alcohol. And so we tended to offer a really horrible cultural explanation. Oh, no, that's just a debased culture. Those people get drunk a lot. Say this about different cultures when alcohol comes in. And there may be there's probably a biological explanation. Did anybody else have information about that? Yeah, I do know alcohol metabolism varies by ethnicity, just like lactose metabolism and our ability to tolerate the Western diet. Yeah, good. Other questions? Okay, let's break there, guys. Enjoy the game. Boy, I'll see you in 2 days. If you're going to the game, enjoy the game. I won't see you. We'll work around you.